Amy Stewart is the award-winning author of 6 books on the perils and pleasures of the natural world, including 4 New York Times bestsellers, Flower Confidential, Wicked Plants, The Drunken Botanist, and the book we're reviewing today, Wicked Bugs, The Louse That Conquered Napoleon's Army and Other Diabolical Insects. Ms. Stewart lives in Eureka, California, where she and her husband own an antiquarian bookstore and tend a flock of unruly hens, I love that part, in their backyard. She has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and has appeared frequently on NPR, CBS Sunday Morning, and just once on TLC's Cake Boss. She is the recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, the American Horticulture Society's Book Award, and a California Horticultural Society Writers Award. Ms. Stewart, thank you for joining us again on The Zesty Garden.
Oh, thanks. My pleasure.
Okay, I just have to ask, the Cake Boss?
Can you believe that? They made a cake out of wicked plants.
Oh, my.
Yes. So it was like a garden of poisonous plants all made out of cake and icing. And it had this big carnivorous Venus flytrap head coming out of it with these long fangs and, you know, like the most menacing cake you can possibly imagine. It was hilarious.
Was it designed to be edible?
Oh, yes. It was wonderful. Yeah.
Oh.
You know, here's the thing about, if you watch The Cake Boss, here's the thing about that show, is the cakes are fantastic. I was kind of expecting a pretty ordinary tasting cake that was mostly for looks, but they're astonishingly good.
Okay. Well, I'm waiting for the next cake to do with bugs. I don't know if that would work very well or not.
Oh, I think it would be awesome. I'd totally go for that.
Okay. So in your introduction to this book, you point out that, and somebody else was pointing out, but you wrote it in, how that we are seriously outnumbered by insects. How many insects are there to every person?
It is true that we are really overwhelmed by insects. There are over 1 million species of insects that we know about, and like 1 billion that are alive on the planet right now, which works out to something like 200 million of them for every one of us.
Yikes. And you would sit in here that there was an article that the Chicago Daily Tribune ran in 1909 entitled, If Bugs Were the Size of Men, and what that would mean if that truly were the case. Give a few examples if you can.
Right. You know, it was kind of this hilarious article. You have to sort of imagine some reporter sitting around trying to figure out how to fill up their, you know, copy for the day, right? Like, what gives you the idea that that's going to be an article that you would write? But basically, it was all about, you know, like really ferocious Hercules beetles that had a taste for drinking and brawling. And bark beetles that could, you know, destroy entire towns, and spiders that could attack elephants. I mean, it was this ridiculous hyperbole, but in a way, it's really true. I mean, the point of it was that while they're very small, they're really quite powerful, and if they were our size, they would totally overwhelm us.
I was going to say, you pointed out they're doing pretty good right now. We don't need to have them any larger than they are.
That's right, yeah. You know, and I should say, you know, when we talk about bugs, I'm using the sort of the layperson's version of that word to include spiders and lots of other creepy crawly creatures that are not scientifically considered bugs. But yeah, they're plenty powerful on their own, which is not to say that they are all evil. Now, I concentrated on the ones that are most likely to cause harm to humans and human affairs. But, you know, it was actually pretty hard to come up with a list of bugs that you should truly be terrified of, because, in fact, most of them do no harm at all and do nothing but good. So I definitely want to get that out of the way first so people understand that.
Well, you do use the word wicked, but in a more general sense.
Right. So my definition of the word wicked is if they have some impact on our lives as humans. So like bugs that eat other bugs, that's not wicked. That's just them doing what they're supposed to do. And bugs that eat plants, also not wicked. I mean, that's what they're put on the earth to eat. So we can hardly get mad at them for doing what they're supposed to do. I mean, they can't order a pizza, right? They really don't have any other options. So when I see bug bites in the leaves of my garden, I think, well, that's what was supposed to happen. That's their food source.
Well, and at the beginning of each particular insect, you have a title. It's either painful or destructive, deadly, horrible, or dangerous.
Right, yes. I was trying to break them down into some kind of category. And dangerous and deadly really mean harmful to us as humans, whereas destructive means that they devour either plants or structures like our homes on such a catastrophic scale that it can really change the course of human events. You know, like Hurricane Katrina is a really good example of that. Formosan subterranean termites were nibbling away at the seams of the flood walls before Katrina hit and definitely contributed to the horrible destruction of that beautiful city. So yeah, it's really about how catastrophic they are to us as people.
So let's talk about the louse that conquered Napoleon's army.
Yeah, well, you know, anytime I could get a famous person involved in these stories, I went for it. So I really sat up and paid attention to anything that involved Christopher Columbus or, you know, George Washington or, in this case, Napoleon. So when Napoleon invaded Russia in 1812, you know, this was the largest army that had ever moved across the face of the earth. It was 500,000 troops, almost 100,000 horses. It was a huge army. And he went in before the weather got cold, and he came limping back out of Russia with only about 5,000 troops left. So it was a catastrophic devastation. And there's a lot of reasons why Napoleon lost in Russia. But one of them was the fact that as the troops were marching across the Russian countryside, there were no laundromats. There was no place for them to wash their clothes, and body lice inhabit the seams of clothing. They don't live on people. They live in our clothes. So, and they spread disease. Unlike head lice, you know, which are basically harmless, just irritating, body lice actually spread typhus, trench fever, all kinds of nasty diseases. So one of the reasons that Napoleon's army failed was the horrible diseases they got from these minuscule little critters living in their clothes.
Well, and you mentioned Columbus when I was reading about the, is it Chigo flea?
Yes.
Okay,
right.
That was just, it was so gross that I had to keep reading it.
I know. I can almost clear a room with that story. people do sort of make like they're going to get up and go, but then they do stick around for it. So can I tell the story?
Please,
or do you think it's going to be too much?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so these are tiny little fleas, Chigo fleas, and they live in the sand in Caribbean. Columbus encountered them in what we now call Haiti. And they burrow under people's toenails and set up camp. They lay eggs. They get comfortable there. And so if you don't have access to modern medicine, then this can cause gangrene and horrible sores and really a lot of pain and infections. And in Columbus's time, they had no understanding of what was going on, really. And some members of his crew were so badly afflicted with these things that they cut off their own toes to get rid of them.
And would they only get under the toenail, or would they go elsewhere?
Well, that's pretty much where they can get traction,
okay.
You know, where they can find a little space to live. And this still happens today. I mean, tourists will pick up these things on vacations. But, you know, you and I, if we notice that our toe is swollen, we'll just go to the doctor, right? And they'll get a pair of tweezers, and they'll clean it out. We'll be fine. But in those days, they didn't understand what was going on, and would end up in pretty bad shape as a result. And actually, people living in Brazil and in poorer places, you know, in that part of the world, do continue to this day to get those terrible infections, and it's for want of decent shoes. So it's actually a real tragedy that we could easily do something about by providing people with just basic clothing that they need.
Well, and this flea keeps the wound open so it can breathe and then lay its eggs, which supposedly are supposed to, once they hatch, they fall back into the sand or fall out?
That's right. So that is where the opportunity for infection shows up, is that the little creature is keeping that wound open and active.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm interviewing author Amy Stewart. She has written a book entitled Wicked Bugs, The Louse That Conquered Napoleon's Army and Other Diabolical Insects. Another one that really popped out at me was one of the first ones in the book. It's the African giant hornet. And a couple of things there with how bees can defend their hive against this hornet, which is just, it's like 5 centimeters. It's just huge. And then also, if you would explain about how runners have been using, I don't know if it's the venom or exactly what, that to help give them an extra little boost while they're running.
Well, yeah. So the Asian giant hornet is truly something that, you know, monster movies could be made about. It is an enormous hornet and a surprisingly aggressive one. So they will actually invade the hives of Japanese honeybees and really massacre them, like literally tear them from limb to limb and steal their young, their larvae, and take those back to their own children as food. So they're pretty monstrous. And Japanese honeybees came up with this incredible response, which is that when they first scout, you know, they send out a hornet to sort of scout the area and decide, yeah, this is a good hive for us to invade. The little Japanese honeybees would lure them inside their nest, their hive, and then surround them, like the whole hive of honeybees would just sort of get into formation and surround them and kind of just, you know, buzz in the air. And basically just through their movement and their proximity would create just enough heat to cook the hornet to death. And interestingly, there's just a tiny range between the, you know, temperature necessary to kill the hornet and that which kills the honeybees. So some of them actually give their lives because it gets a little too hot. But that is how they have figured out how to kill these things. And you just think, that's really a lot of intelligence for a swarm of honeybees to figure out.
Well, and it says the so-called Asian giant hornet is known locally as the yak killer.
Right. I mean, it is quite large. It's a very, very painful sting, and it can kill people, too, especially someone who's maybe frail or elderly or weak from illness or a very young child. It could actually be fatal. But you're right. So you asked about athletes. So the thing is that these adult hornets don't really live on much food at all. They've got this incredible metabolism, but they're mostly running around gathering food for their young and carrying it back to them. And when they feed their young, the little baby hornets sort of look up at their parents and offer up what's called a kiss, and it's a little drop of nectar, and the parents take a sip of that, and that's what gives them energy to keep doing what they're doing. And so somebody got to wondering what would happen, what's in that stuff, and what would happen if we fed it to athletes. And now there is actually a sort of it's not actually made from hornet juice, but it mimics the amino acid content of it. So there actually is a hornet juice that's on sale as a supplement for athletes that supposedly gives them the energy that these Asian hornets have.
Man, how do you? I could just imagine trying to collect this stuff when you first start wondering about it.
Exactly. It would not be easy. I could see somebody doing it in a laboratory once, and I think it has been done a little bit, but you certainly could not do it on a large enough scale to, you know, bottle it and sell it.
Now, in the book, you do talk about how we can use some common sense to determine whether an insect is good or bad. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, so first of all, keep in mind, first of all, that most bugs that you encounter in the wild are perfectly harmless and can't hurt you at all. And size does have something to do with it. You know, there are, for instance, lots of spiders that are much too small to break the skin or you know, really bite or hurt someone. And really, I think it takes understanding where you live and really getting some hard information about what actually lives there that could pose a threat. For instance, everybody thinks they have brown recluse spiders just waiting out their front door to attack them. And in fact, the brown recluse inhabits a relatively small area of the United States, mostly in central states, sort of starting from Texas and working its way up and out. But everybody who lives in a state that doesn't have brown recluse is just shocked when I tell them that they don't have any in their state, and they actually get kind of upset.
They insist that they've seen one.
I know we have them.
Yeah, I know. I get that all the time. Oh, I saw a brown recluse, and I tell them, no, brown recluses don't exist in Utah.
Right.
Or unless they happen to come in a box or something, and then they're not going to last very long. But, yeah, they insist that they've seen one or have been bitten by one. It's, no, they do not exist in Utah. So they are even confined more than I thought. So basically the southern tier of the U.S.?
Well, yeah, exactly. Southern and central. Now, their habitat is expanding. You know, I mean, one of the things that's happening with climate change and our shifting weather patterns is that all sorts of plants and insects and animals are kind of moving around a little bit. So it is one thing that entomologists are keeping an eye on is, you know, is their range expanding as weather changes?
So as far as telling the difference, you're looking at size. And then you also mentioned curiosity. How does that play into it?
Curiosity of the insect?
Yeah, how to determine whether an insect is good or bad.
Well, I mean, you know, I think it's important for us as people to, again, to be knowledgeable about what, you know, what lives where, and also to stay away from nests, you know, to really think about what is that creature doing and what is it maybe trying to defend. And knowing something about habitat, for instance, if you've got camping gear stored in a shed out back, you know, that's a perfect insect habitat, and that's a really good time to be careful as you're shaking that kind of stuff out. So I think it really has to do with, you know, taking the time to really understand the creatures a little bit.
I know you also have here in the book, it talks about the different kinds of people, dead insect syndrome, perfect leaf syndrome, and so forth. Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because I found that, for me, it's kind of a no reaction. It's like I understand that they're just part of outdoor life. In fact, I once housed a cat-faced spider above the sink because it was so fascinating to watch it capture flies in the house.
Right. I've done the same thing. I actually had a European cross spider build a web inside my kitchen window. And I called a friend of mine who's an entomologist, and I said, you know, I'm just delighted to have this spider here, and she's just getting bigger every day, and she's so fascinating. Is there anything wrong with me just keeping her here? And he said, well, there's nothing wrong with it, but you should know that she is pregnant and that she's going to have about 200 babies sometime in late October. So you may find one spider charming in your kitchen. You might not find 200 of them. And I said, oh. So we ended up moving her outside. But, yeah, the whole thing about people's fears is so a team of entomologists described the different responses that people have when they encounter insects in the wild. And so one of them, like you mentioned, is no reaction, which means people who understand that bugs are part of life in the outdoors and you should just live with them. They talked about dead insect syndrome, which is, you know, the only good insect is a dead insect and we should kill everything. Perfect leaf syndrome, which is, you know, people get alarmed if they see a bite in a leaf, which means that they forget that that is, in fact, what they're supposed to eat, and they don't have anything else to eat, so that is what they should be doing. Entomophobia, just an irrational fear that keeps people out of nature just because they are so afraid of encountering a bug. And another one that I thought was really interesting, and this is their term, the environmentalist response, which means people believing that insecticides should never be used in any situation and favor the protections of all bugs under all circumstances. And it's interesting that even the most environmentally, you know, friendly entomologist will agree that there are times when, you know, some insecticides may be necessary, you know, obviously ones that aren't harmful to the environment or other creatures, but that there is a balancing act there.
Do you know, I was fascinated with how many of these insects require blood meals. It's like,
right,
for crying out loud, why do they have to bite me for? So
exactly, yeah. The females particularly, when they are having babies, they need something more than a little nectar or a leaf to get them by. And I'm sure anyone who has ever lived with a pregnant woman understands this syndrome. So yeah, very often it's the females, and very often it's during, you know, during mating season that they seek out a blood meal. And so the males tend to hover nearby, just waiting for the females to show up. So if you've ever found yourself in a swarm of little flying insects, and you know wondered what's going on, chances are you're surrounded by a bunch of males that figure that you are the next likely target, and they're just waiting for the women to turn up for dinner, which would be you.
Do you know, I remember playing baseball when I was a kid, and I'm like, why are these bugs just flying around my head? So those were the males waiting for a female to show up to take a bite out of me.
Exactly.
Ah, okay. Well, why don't you talk about one of these insects, the assassin bug? This one, another one, a famous person involves Charles Darwin.
Yeah. Assassin bugs are really interesting creatures. They're quite large, for one thing. Often a good inch or two. And there are a lot of different species of assassin bugs that live throughout South America and on into the Southwest. In fact, you guys may have some in Utah. I would assume that you do. But the one that Darwin encountered is a particular species found in South America. He was in Argentina. He was on his voyage on the Beagle that he went on as a young man, which was sort of his first attempt at being a naturalist. And he noticed this biting insect, this large, soft-bodied creature, the assassin bug. And he wrote in his journal about being bitten by the assassin bug. And he also wrote about putting some of the crew members in a circle around a table and having them put their hands out on the table and letting the assassin bug go around and take a bite out of each of them. And I have to think about Darwin talking people into doing this, right? Like, what kind of personality must he have had that he could persuade people to do a thing like that?
Well, wasn't it Darwin that found, he peeled some bark off of a tree, and he found these really cool-looking beetles, and he had one in each hand, and then he saw another one, and he wanted to get that one too, so he put the second one in his mouth.
Yes. That is Darwin. He thought that his mouth was one more storage place for insects. And in that case, he made a new discovery because it turned out to be a kind of beetle that squirted out this really nasty fluid whenever it was confined. But anyway, Darwin, unbeknownst to Darwin, the assassin bug spread a nasty disease called Chagas disease, which was a disease that was unknown until the early 20th century. And it is possible, we'll never really know for sure, but it is possible that that Darwin was sick for most of his life and died as a result of Chagas disease. Certainly some of the symptoms that he experienced his whole life were similar to those of Chagas disease.
And so many of these insects, that's what's happening. They're passing on diseases. When you look at fleas and the plague, mosquitoes and malaria, it's amazing there's still humans living on the planet with as much that goes around.
And the other thing that's amazing, too, is that we here in North America are really pretty fortunate. I mean, you know, Lyme disease is an issue for us, and there are a few other insect-transmitted diseases that we need to be aware of. But the fact is that there are people living all over the world with really devastating insect-transmitted diseases that we used to have to deal with here in this country. But we took care of it. We got rid of it. And we did it through some really simple innovations like clean drinking water and good sanitation and sewage systems and very simple pills and vaccines and very minimal safe forms of pest control. Really easy and inexpensive solutions, but we've not exactly seen fit to share those with the rest of the world. So a lot of people are still living with really dreadful insect-transmitted diseases, and really the only reason is that we haven't extended enough of a helping hand to give people access to these same luxuries that we have here.
And even to the point of just having clean water, which we just never think about, is a luxury for so many.
That's right. We never think about it. You know, I tell people all the time when I'm out giving lectures, there's a lot of talk right now about government-run healthcare. And the fact is that our water system, the fact that I can turn on a tap anywhere in this country and get parasite-free water to drink, and the fact that there's a functional sewage system, you know, no matter where I go in this country, a toilet flushes and sewage goes away. I don't know where it goes. All I know is that I don't have to bury it in my backyard. That's astonishingly powerful and wonderful government health care right there. Mm. I mean, those are publicly run systems, and they work so well, and our lives are infinitely better because of them. So I only wish people had what we have as far as that stuff goes.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm interviewing author Amy Stewart. She has written a book entitled Wicked Bugs, The Louse That Conquered Napoleon's Army and Other Diabolical Insects.
I also wanted to look at a couple of insects that seem like they're extremely intelligent, but they just have a way of outsmarting humans. One of those that fascinated me was the corn rootworm.
Oh, yes. This is a really interesting story. You know, this is a pest of corn, obviously, and it lays its eggs underground so that when the eggs hatch, the little larvae need corn plants, the roots of corn plants, to feed on, you know, to get the next generation going. So the assumption when they lay their eggs in the fall is that another crop of corn is going to be planted there in the spring so they'll have something to eat. And that's a logical assumption. I mean, corn, even if it was a wild plant, it would be an annual. Seeds would drop to the ground and regenerate the next year. So what farmers realized is, you know what? We could outsmart these creatures by just planting soybeans every other year. And then there would be no corn when the little larvae wake up in the spring and they would die off. So that's one of many reasons for that corn-soybean rotation. It worked well for a while, but it really only took a few decades for corn rootworms to figure out a couple of different ways to outsmart the farmers. One thing that they did is that they started laying eggs that could sleep through a year of soybean and wait for the corn to come back the following year. And then there's sort of another strain of them that began laying eggs that could either eat corn or soybeans, so they would be fine on either crop. So it's pretty amazing, you know, that there's a real numbers game that happens with insects. There's so many more of them than there are of us that you know, their evolutionary responses happen really fast, and it really only took a few decades for them to adapt and have this new strategy so that the farmers are left once again scratching their heads and wondering what they're going to do.
So it's just a matter of, like you said, there are so many that a few will lay eggs that just happen to be able to stay in the soil that long, and the other ones die off, and those are the ones that survive and continue to keep the species.
Exactly.
I was looking at your pain index. Do you want to talk about this pain index in the book?
Yes, the Schmidt Pain Index. So this is a wonderful entomologist, Justin Schmidt, who developed a way of categorizing how painful stings are. And believe it or not, this is not something that had really been done. I mean, no one had really come up with a scientific way to measure how painful a sting is. And when he originally wrote his pain index, it was kind of dry and straightforward, but over time it became more elaborate and descriptive, and it started to sound more like wine descriptors. You know, so for instance, the sting of a yellow jacket he describes as hot and smoky, almost irreverent. Imagine W.C. Fields extinguishing a cigar on your tongue.
Now that's pretty descriptive.
Yes, it is. This could only be written by someone who had, you know, experienced each of these enough to really understand the difference. So, like, bald-faced hornet is rich, hearty, and slightly crunchy, similar to getting your hand mashed in a revolving door.
Well, I love this one for the red harvester ant. Bold and unrelenting, somebody is using a drill to excavate your ingrown toenail.
Oh. Yes, I'm glad to say that I don't have much personal experience with any of those.
Well, and one thing to point out is these are not all exotic insects that we wouldn't have. Many of them are ones that we deal with. You talk about the Colorado potato beetle and how it had become so destructive. You've already mentioned the deer tick. A lot of these that we still have, and they're not as destructive or harmful to us as they would have been because we've got the good sanitation, but many of them do affect us in other ways, whether they're painful or they're destructive to crops.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a real wide range here, and of course their roles are continuously changing. You know, we've had things like the brown marmorated stink bug, which came in on the East Coast, and at first didn't look terribly harmful. It looked very annoying, but not very harmful. And over time, as its numbers have increased, it has gone from being just an annoyance to something that really poses a major threat to agriculture. You know, I think we take a lot of them for granted. Things like the Mediterranean fruit fly, if it ever got a hold here, would actually destroy our ability to grow our own food in this country, period. And I don't think people realize what a big threat that is.
So how do those in the Mediterranean deal with it?
Well, so part of the thing is, you know, you have to remember that when we get an invasive species, often what happens is that it is it flourishes in absence of any natural predators or in absence of whatever weather conditions might keep it in check somewhere else. And so that's really the problem with all of these, you know, invasive pests that are destructive for agriculture, is that whatever's keeping it in check in its native land doesn't exist here. And so then we talk about starting to import whatever it is that eats it, and then we have to wonder, well, what's going to happen when that thing gets a foothold? You know, it starts to become this kind of insect arm race.
And then sometimes nature here does eventually catch up with that imported insect. For instance, we have the European paper wasp, which showed up here 10, 15 years ago.
Oh.
And up until just a few years ago, the numbers were just humongous. They were all over the place. But now there's a natural protozoan that seems to be causing some issues where the adults get infected and they can't fly. The larvae never hatch. So we've really begun to see the numbers depressing. So there is something in nature that's looked at that vacuum and it's trying to take care of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, there are, you know, things have a way of balancing out.
Okay, so we have just a few minutes left. I did want to talk to you about one that I just found. It was just so bad that, again, I had to keep reading it. The screwworm fly.
Oh,
and you have
right.
one particular story in there of a man who had an experience with this fly.
Right. You know, this is a great example of one of those creatures that we used to have here and don't as much anymore because we figured out how to solve the problem. So here's the horrible story, which I'm sure will give everyone nightmares, is a guy in the 1950s sitting out in his backyard in California, and there's all these flies buzzing around, and he's swatting at them, and he feels this itch in his nose that makes him sneeze. So when he sneezes, there's a fly. A fly comes out of his nose, and he realizes that one must have gotten up there, and that's what made him sneeze. But then his face started to swell up, and he went to the doctor, and it turns out that in the short time that fly had been in his nose, it had laid eggs in there. Mm. So he was actually washing out little fly larvae from this man's nose. And something like a couple hundred of them came out, all told, by the time they finished. You know, it took several tries to get everything out. So, I mean, that is just, if that's not the beginning of a monster movie, I don't know what is.
And then you talk about the giant centipede, and I think there was someone in England who happened to find, a neighbor had it as a pet, and he just happened to find it in his house. He didn't know what it was, and you talk about how it will go into caves and hang down from the top of the cave and catch a bat.
Yeah. The only way we know this is that actually bat scientists had rigged up some caves with, you know, cameras that can, you know, night-sensing cameras, so they could see what goes on when they're not around. And they were astonished to watch the film and to see this in action, these enormous centipedes. I'm talking about a creature, you know, a foot long or more, hanging from just its back few legs, hanging in midair and actually grabbing bats as they fly by in the dark. Which, here's the thing about that to me, is, you know, I will sometimes get a little flack from entomologists for talking about these insects as if they have a brain like ours and they're making decisions and they're thinking about things. But you see a centipede hanging upside down to grab a bat out of the air, how is it not thinking, right? Like, can't you just see them laying around at night going, wait a minute, I have an idea. Watch this, guys. And I mean, who tries that for the first time and finds out that that works?
If I hang just right, I might be able to catch something as it's coming in.
It just seems like a lot of premeditation is all I'm saying.
I also, to end, I wanted to talk about night crawlers. Now, they're not really an insect. But are they really destructive?
Well, they can be in the wrong place. So what people don't realize about night crawlers, which, you know, we're talking about earthworms now, is that the species that we think of as night crawlers, Limbricus terrestris, is a European